Good morning. I'm here today to tell you about some in-depth interviews that we conducted in August of 2009, and these were with pediatricians in three cities, Houston, Chicago, and San Francisco. First, I'd like to acknowledge the people who supported this research, our principal investigator, Alan Janssen, Richard Tardif with ORISE, my colleagues at CDC, Tanya Johnson, John O'Connor, Kelly Jackson, Abigail Tumpy, Pamela Bryant, Chris Sheedy, and lastly, Dr. Mark Herring, who conducted the interviews for us in each of the cities. This was part of a larger research project that included not only pediatricians, but also pediatric nurses, nurse practitioners, and other healthcare workers. This part of the project focuses on pediatricians' comments. And if you'd like to learn more about the other healthcare providers, there's a session this afternoon with Tanya Johnson at 2 p.m. Our first objective was to assess pediatricians' opinions about the best ways to educate parents about the 2009 H1N1 vaccines. And our second objective was to apply the lessons we learned to CDC's education efforts. But first, I want to give you a little bit of background about things that were happening in the months before we did these interviews. In March of 2009, the first cases of a new flu were reported in Mexico and then in Southern California near the U.S.-Mexico border. In April, a school district was closed in San Antonio, Texas, and a young child from Mexico died in a Texas hospital. And this was the first flu-related death that happened outside of Mexico. In May, a young Texas woman died after giving birth in her eighth month of pregnancy. And the media reported that she had underlying health conditions, including asthma. This was the first flu-related death of a U.S. resident. In June, the World Health Organization declared a worldwide flu pandemic. And in July, the U.S. military began planning for the fall. In August, the month when we did these interviews, eight sites across the United States had just started clinical trials of the H1N1 vaccines. This made news headlines across the country. This was a protest event in San Francisco. Nurses and hospital workers were leading a protest. This was a month after a nurse had died, and they were demanding protection for both themselves and their patients. And this was just a few weeks before we arrived in San Francisco to do our interviews. So first, a quick overview of our methods. For our inclusion criteria, we included only board-certified pediatricians who spent much of their time with direct contact with pediatric patients. To collect data, we conducted 30-minute interviews with the pediatricians. We used a structured interview guide, meaning we had standard questions we asked each pediatrician. We had a worksheet where we asked them to rate their anticipated use of vaccines. And finally, we provided them with a product profile for the new vaccines. And this outlined how the vaccines were manufactured, cost, availability, anticipated side effects. We carefully observed the interviews and took notes. And to analyze the data, I and two of my colleagues, we analyzed the notes independently and then we came back together. It was very much a back and forth process, and we finally reached a consensus on key themes and categories. And then we identified some of the lessons and ways we could apply them at CDC. Here are five of the themes we identified, topics that pediatricians felt parents needed to know about regarding the H1N1 vaccines, the best ways they felt we could reach parents with this information, the best ways we could provide pediatricians with information so that they in turn could educate parents. And they also commented about language, readability, and the best tone to use in these messages. So first, topics that parents need to know about. One of the first topics pediatricians mentioned was does my child even need the vaccine? They anticipated this would be a question they would be hearing from parents. And this sort of ties in with Emuela's comments about the health belief model. We heard a lot of that about parents' perceptions about the severity of the disease. You know, will my child, if my child even gets this new flu, will it be that bad? Does my child need the vaccine? And why so many shots? Vaccine safety was another major concern that pediatricians were already getting questions from parents about. There was quite a bit of concern among not only parents, but also pediatricians about how the new vaccines were being tested. There was this perception that the testing was being rushed and that perhaps corners were being cut and that may be affecting the safety of the vaccine. Several pediatricians, as you can see from these comments, were concerned that parents would not want their child to be getting a shot that was so new. And other safety questions. They wanted to know about the ingredients. They wanted to know about the side effects. Autism came up, and also thimerosal. That was often mentioned by pediatricians as something that parents had already been asking them about. And efficacy was another comment pediatricians mentioned. They said parents need to know, what is this vaccine going to protect children from? And several pediatricians mentioned in the past, not with the H1N1 vaccines, but with flu vaccines in general, that parents had this misunderstanding. They thought, if my child gets this flu shot, my child will be protected from all flus. They didn't understand about the match between the vaccine and the virus. And they also had concerns about, you know, will this flu vaccine give my child the flu? So when we asked pediatricians the best ways to reach parents, quite a few pediatricians said they wanted posters for their waiting rooms and their exam rooms. Several pediatricians said they thought it would be great to have a poster that could be updated regularly with CDC information, sort of a swine flu information center. That's their words, not mine. And they also talked about what they perceived to be media hype. They felt that media coverage was stirring up parents' worries and fears unnecessarily, and they felt that CDC needed to do more, needed to have a bigger presence on TV. And public service announcements on TV and radio. Several pediatricians commented on how it would be great to have to reach out to different media, to Hispanic radio stations, for example, for people who don't speak English well. And the best ways to reach pediatricians, several pediatricians said parents read the news, they surf the web, and they come to them with questions. Pediatricians do not want to be blindsided with these questions. They want to be kept up to date. They said they wanted regular updates. Some defined regular as daily. Some said more than once a day. Others said weekly. They asked that CDC guidelines that are posted on the web be kept up to date. And then they talked about information overload. They said they were getting information from not only CDC, but also from their professional organizations. And sometimes it was too much, and sometimes that information wasn't consistent. And this was, we heard this in all three cities. Our materials have to be easy for people to understand. We can't be providing too much information, or people will not remember what we're telling them. They won't comprehend it. And this sort of drives home a message about the need to focus on need-to-know information, not nice-to-know information. Because when people are under a lot of stress, their level of comprehension comes down in what the pediatricians are telling them and also what they read. So it's very important for us to not overload people with information. And they ask for information to be translated into other languages. They also mentioned, several pediatricians said they have parents who are quite well-educated and well-read. Those parents want more than basics, and they said CDC needs to find a way to provide them with that information. All of the pediatricians, almost all, said they trusted CDC as a trusted source. They felt that parents trust CDC. And they felt that our messages needed to convey that trustworthiness. And they, of course, we need to be truthful, but they also ask us to be reassuring and not alarming in our messages. And as you can see from these comments, they felt that we needed to do more than we were doing at that time. Pediatricians rely on CDC for the latest information so that they can educate their parents and answer their questions. That was one lesson we heard loud and clear. They want materials they can easily find on the web, print out, and give to parents, and these materials must be easy to understand, regardless of the language they're in, not just in English, but when they're translated, that needs to be in plain language as well. We must avoid information overload, but we need to find a way to get additional information to parents who do want that extra information. We should continue to use a variety of channels and media and languages to reach parents, and our messages should not only be accurate and timely, but consistent and, when possible, reassuring in tone. That's not always possible. So how have we applied these lessons learned? Since we conducted these interviews, we've used these key questions to develop the materials for pediatricians and for parents. We've used diverse channels to reach parents and pediatricians, not only print materials, but also email, podcasts, Medscape videos, as well as Twitter and Facebook. We provide online access to materials that pediatricians can download, print, and give to parents, and that parents can download on their own. And we provide layered information on the web so that parents who want to know more than the basics can find it. And by layered, what I mean is on the main page, we have just the basics, but we include hyperlinks so that parents who want to know more can get to that information. We've also strengthened our efforts to make sure that the materials we put out there are clear and consistent. We now do systematic reviews. We work with other federal agencies to make sure our information is consistent. We also, you may have heard this in another session yesterday, syndicated content. We have a technological tool that we use so that information on the CDC website, our guidelines, as that information is updated, it's automatically updated on our partner sites that are including the same information. That's one way we can ensure that we're providing consistent messages. We also do back translation of our translated materials. This just means that once we've translated it into another language, we translate it back into English to make sure nothing has been lost in the translation. And when possible, we use reassuring messages. And more recently, we've been working with other federal agencies to develop materials that describe the ingredients in vaccines. So, in summary, we did have a few limitations because this was a qualitative study and it included only 28 pediatricians. We can't generalize this to all pediatricians in the United States. There also is the potential for bias. Namely, the pediatricians knew that CDC was conducting this research, and they may have been telling us some things that they thought we wanted to hear. And it's costly to do these interviews and time-consuming to do the data analysis. Some of the strengths, though, this provides an opportunity to find out the reasons behind some of the quantitative data we've seen on H1N1. And also, this is valued in communication research because it allows us to identify problems with our messages so that we can correct them in midstream. And it lays the groundwork for future research on vaccine safety. And finally, it also supports theories such as the health belief model. So, thank you. And now we welcome your questions.
Thank you very much, Valerie, and to our entire panel this morning. So right now we'd like to open up the floor for a few questions. I think we have a few minutes before the lunch break here, so please step to the microphone so that we can hear your question.
Good morning. Thank you for the presentations. This is probably channeled to the whole panel, if you will, but I did have a specific question for, is it Ermela?
Emuela. Mm-hmm.
Sorry if I mispronounce your name. For the coalition, Dr. Baker, you presented before, being a parent of small children and being a healthcare professional, I was thinking that in the event of a natural or a pandemic or an epidemic, we can have people that are visibly stationed in the doctor's office, because sometimes that calms parents down while the pediatricians are seeing other patients, because they're not always as friendly and have the time to address questions when vaccinating children. And, you know, being a mom, I understand that. So hopefully there will be some way that advocates can be positioned in the doctor's offices, even in conjunction with the United States Public Health Service, to get more people hands-on, because that personal touch does not, it's needed. I know CDC is doing a great job, as you talked about with the public service announcement. I read the brochures and the pamphlets, and that's great. But sometimes somebody to calm the spirit of those parents that are waiting in that wait room, because we don't always have in doctor's offices where you isolate children in the sick room or the sick section and the well section. So there is some type of ways where we can have people stationed, if you will. That may be a little more costly, something to think about. Also, in these researches, especially with MedImmune, I saw that we didn't have a lot of minority participation. There was about 4%, right? And I think it will skew some of the health belief models, because there is a lack of trust that healthcare professionals are still, we don't know how to address it. As far as minority populations with perception, availability, and knowledge. I would like to see for healthcare professionals a cross comparison study with us vaccinating our own children. What is the rate of infection that we give our children when we don't get vaccinated? I know in the public health service, they stick us all the time, but there are still healthcare professionals that do not vaccinate their children. So it would kind of be interesting to look at that. Also, why African Americans or Latinos or Asian Americans are not participating in some of these studies, because there is a cultural belief that is quite different and that will have a separate outcome in your health belief models. So that's all I wanted to say, but thank you.
Thank you.
Can I make a comment?
Sure, absolutely.
Just to make a comment, and seeing as the coalition's website was on my last slide, we do have educational materials for 7 different Asian languages and Hispanics, as well as English. So that's just a source of information available on pediatric influenza that would reach all languages. They have been transadapted, not just translated, to be culturally appropriate. Doesn't address your African-American question, because I do think we need more research on that. The Latinos that I care for, the majority of my practice now in Houston, Texas, whites are in a minority in that city. Many of them are immigrants, either recent immigrants or first generation. Those are the most vaccine accepting people I've ever seen, because they've seen the diseases. Now, that's not pertinent necessarily just to flu, I'm talking about the other diseases. But I think the African American situation, that none of our presentations specifically have addressed ways that we might be able to break through. I try and do it one-on-one and feel fairly successful. But there's a lot that needs to be done.
Just one quick comment. We did look at our results by race, ethnicity, and we didn't find any differences, but the sample was small. So it does, I agree with you, it warrants additional research.
Time for the 2 more quick questions in line there.
I'm Lance Chilton from Albuquerque. A question for Dr. Johnson, and then for Carol and Dr. Flood. Dr. Johnson, you mentioned that messages should be reassuring. To what extent must you balance reassuring with a realistic perception of the burden of disease and the possibility of death from flu?
I totally agree with you, and that's our dilemma, because we have to be honest, we have to be truthful, and when we can't be reassuring, we have to be honest. So it's a balancing act. I can give you one example of when you can be reassuring. For example, you know, we can, when we're telling people how many people have been vaccinated with H1N1 vaccine safely, that's something we can honestly say and we can be reassuring. I guess I was just putting this out here to let everyone know. Pediatricians want us to be certain. Parents want us to be 100% certain. They want us to be reassuring. We can't always do that. But when we can, we do.
And for Carol and Ms. Flood, a question regarding school-located influenza immunization. It looks like, at least in the early part of the school-located influenza immunization business, we hit a ceiling effect of about 45 or 50% at most in our project in Knoxville and in Maryland. That's lower than one would predict from your data, both of you. Can you speculate as to why that is and how we could get above that ceiling?
I'm going to answer your first question first regarding reassuring, and then I'll let you speak. To me, reassurance, vaccine is safe. Vaccine won't give you the flu. That's the reassurance. The other side, which can be emotional because it is, I see people die from flu, healthy children every year. I have a special hospital-based practice. That's the scary side. So I do think it's a balance. And the honesty is, vaccine is safe, efficacious. Don't need to go into the mismatch thing. If you don't vaccinate, you have zero protection. Even in a 40% protection year, you have 40% versus zero. So to me, reassurance is on the vaccine side, and the disease side is scary, and you don't have to scare them to death. And I'll let you take the second question.
Actually, I am a bit surprised at the percentages that you reported. So I would have expected those numbers to be better, particularly given, you know, the fact that with that medium likelihood group, convenience was definitely an issue and reported to be a key driver for convenience as well as a key barrier for inconvenience. So I'm a bit surprised by that. But of course, with barriers, I think barriers are key, and there are multiple barriers. So convenience is one of them, but there are others. So there are some parents who are concerned about thimerosal, for example, and that's extremely important to them. And that's, of course, a fear-based issue. And so even education efforts towards, you know, the fact that there's no link, no established link with thimerosal isn't enough, because the risk for those parents is just too great. Even we found in our qualitative work that, in fact, they often have a lot of information on thimerosal, and they know that there's no link in as far as evidence of a link, yet they still are not willing to take what they consider that to be that risk.
And just to comment, I was very pleased to see that the main themes and messages were almost identical in the two studies. And so whether it's a third or 25% or higher, I think it's going to depend on regions and cultural differences, et cetera. But there are a lot of parents that are concerned and just want to have a conversation. And whether it's with the nurse who's administering the vaccine, the doctor, I agree that additional things can be done, posters. We actually, at the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Awareness and Research, have posters for sale for the expensive price of $1.75. I can't even get a cup of coffee in this hotel for less than $2.50 and a tip. To have a laminated poster in a room that gives a personal story of a normal child that was lost to influenza and how the parent would really wish that they had vaccinated them, to information, I think there's a variety of messaging that will reach certainly the majority of parents.
And one more brief question before we adjourn here.
It is brief. My name is Francie Tisdale. I'm from southwestern Colorado. I would also like to validate that the Hispanics in our population by far responded exponentially better to both flu and H1N1 and seasonal flu. My question, and one other thing, I think that the CDC or and all of the immunization organizations could advance the cause or to diminish concern about thimerosal by explaining how much daily exposure we have to mercury in the atmosphere. I mean, breathing the air, we get more thimerosal, the more mercury than we do in vaccine. I think it could be a very well-executed campaign. My question, though, is I'm a public health nurse, immunization nurse. We are expected to promote and administer flu vaccine right through spring. And parents don't care after January, after the giant push. Is there some plan in the next year's campaign to advocate, if you haven't gotten your child's flu vaccine by January, it's not too late? I don't see too much about that. I'd love to see that more.
Well, the coalition, did I turn this off? The coalition actually in 2007 began that message. And, you know, the typical peak is in February in most places, and it extends into March, April, and May. But that's a hard message to get across. The CDC, I think, failed initially to get that point out. They're on board also. I think this year's H1N1, because of the availability of the vaccine coming so late, got people over the Thanksgiving barrier, and hopefully we can figure out ways to message that successfully in the upcoming year by reminding them of such things as H1N1 is still around and it's in the new seasonal vaccine, so you need to be sure that your child is protected and your whole family.
And with that, thank you so much again to our panel. Please join me in